a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Greetings to everybody who is here. We would want to get the House Retirement Laws Committee Joint Committee meeting started. I would like to welcome everybody here, and including those on the internet listeners forever on the internet, as it is. We will have a House and a Senate Retirement Laws will both be hearing the actuarial report. The Senate will then adjourn, and the House will proceed with the hearing and considering the three bills that we do have on the agenda for this afternoon. I would like to ask the Secretary to do the roll call.
Representative Feinstein, Kirschman,
here.
Perry,
here.
Wick,
here.
Steele,
here.
Chair, there's a quorum.
Thank you. I would then like to turn it over to Senator Rambelberg and have the call the Senate for their.
Thank you, Representative Steele. And I will call the meeting to order for the state or the Senate Retirement Laws Committee and ask the Secretary to call the roll.
Senator Buell, Sutton,
here.
Tiedemann,
here.
Nelson,
here.
Rambelberg.
Thank you. We have a quorum.
Thank you. To keep things rolling here, I would like to introduce Mr. Elmer Brinkman. I'd like to have him come up to the chair here. He's the chair of the Retirement Board of Trustees, and share with us what he would like to. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and good afternoon.
Is there a button there?
I am Elmer Brinkman, the chair of the South Dakota Retirement System Board of Trustees. I'm the county commissioner from Addington County. As always, thanks on behalf of the 75,000 members of the South Dakota Retirement System. We've appreciated working with you during the last year, and we look forward to a positive relationship in the future. We ask you, please, feel free to contact us anytime that we can be of assistance. And before we proceed with the hearing this afternoon, Mr. Chairman, I'd ask a little privilege to allow the Board of Trustee members who are here to introduce themselves. Would that be okay?
Yes, please do. Thank you.
All right. Would those board members behind me please stand and introduce yourself to the committee?
Matt Clark.
Louise Loban-Valga, representing the classified members.
Okay. Laura Gustafson.
James Hansen, representing retirees from here.
I believe that's it. We're always appreciative of our board being here to help us with our relationship with the legislature. At this time, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Wiley, and Mr. Hubbard of our staff will handle the testimony on behalf of the system and the Board of Trustees, and unless the board has questions of me, I would yield to them for their presentations.
Thank you, Mr. Brinkman. I don't believe there is at this time. If there is later, we may call you back. But we'd like to turn it over to Mr. Rob Wiley now to present his part. Thank you for being here, each one.
Thank you. I did miss a couple of you, I believe, with handouts. If I may just make a quick check.
Please do. Great. We want to make sure everybody has the proper paperwork. Thank you.
So, do I get page pay for that then, or? I don't know if my boss will go along with that.
We do not want to get into that.
Rob Wiley, the Executive Director of the South Dakota Retirement System. Pleasure to be before you again today. The efforts today are to bring you up to speed with the actuarial valuation that was completed this last summer on the fiscal year 2010 performance of the South Dakota retirement system and the experience of the assets and the liabilities that are accompanying that plan. With following me, we'll just make a couple preliminary remarks, and then Dave Schlesinski from Buck Consultants, our actuarial firm out of Denver, is here to give you the run-through on the actuarial summary that we have before you. But let me make just a couple preliminary remarks, and virtually every one of you and I have talked about this, but we did have an outstanding year in 2010. Investment performance was terrific. You heard, those of you in appropriations this morning heard that it was the top return in the nation for any single public employee retirement system. And it's been a great testimony to the people at the investment office at how hard they work and how successful they've been. And part of the reason, a great part of the reason, why our beneficiaries receive the benefits that they do, and we have had the sustainability and support of all of our South Dakota citizens for this plan, is that we've been successful in earning those investment returns that have made this plan what it is today. In accompaniment with that, during the last year, and you'll all remember, we went through a lot of work towards it, but we also took corrective actions to bring us back into actuarial alignment. 2009 was the toughest year we ever had in the South Dakota retirement system in its 35 years existence. We were down 20% in assets, and the things relating to the marketplace were going in the wrong direction. We had some issues that were subsidies in the plan itself that we needed to take action on and deal with. Those were taken care of also. We did all those tough things that you have to do. It worked out very well. And returns then came back after those down years in 2008 and 2009. And while it's not in this report, I'm happy to tell you that we've continued with the good performance, and things have worked out extremely well with some of the changes that we've made in the law last year, particularly the retire and return to work provisions are working, I think, maybe more completely than we had envisioned they would, with dramatic declines in the usage of that type of benefit, and also the number of people who were currently grandfathered in has dropped dramatically also. It has been a good year. We keep knocking on wood and hope for it to continue to be very positive, but we're also very proud that all of those things that we've talked about, those things that we've tried to put into practice, have worked the way we anticipated they would, and that things have moved forward in such a way that makes SDRS, again, one of the most well-funded, the most certainly one of the most sustainable plans in the nation. And we're very proud and happy to be in that position, considering what you see in the media about how other things are going in other states. And I just am here to tell you that we don't feel like we have those same issues as the folks around the country, and everything has been much improved. But we are still going to have our down times. We're on an upswing right now, but we're just doing everything we can to make sure we can weather whatever storm there is. That's the short comments I would make on this. And then, Mr. Chair, or Chairs, I would suggest that I introduce Dave Schlesinski with Buck Consultants. He's our actuary, to take you through this report then.
Thank you much. Please, if you would, introduce yourself and look forward to your presentation.
My name is David Schlesinski. I'm a consulting actuary with Buck Consultants out of Denver. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm happy to be here to present the 2010 actuarial valuation results of the South Dakota retirement system. If you turn to page 2 in this handout, the first piece provides a description of the South Dakota retirement system mission statement and a statement of long-term retirement benefit goals, which includes providing a lifetime income replacement, including primary Social Security and additional personal savings of at least 85% of final average compensation to SDRS members. And in that goal is a replacement providing SDRS benefits that meet at least 55% of pre-retirement income for career employees. Now, annually we perform an actuarial valuation on the system. In essence, it's like taking a camera and taking a snapshot of the system. We collect a lot of information, information on all of the members of the system. We utilize the benefit provisions that are defined in statutes. We collect the information on the financial position of the system. And then we take that along with actuarial assumptions and methods and determine the actuarial soundness of the system given those assets and the projected future contributions to be made by members and the employers. So with that, I'm going to present the funded status report or the results of those calculations. In essence, what we do is we project those benefit payments out into the future for every single individual member of the plan and then discount those back to the valuation date to come up with a present value and then compare that with the assets and the contributions. One of the first important measures of actuarial soundness is to determine whether or not the contributions are sufficient to amortize any unfunded liability over a period not to exceed 30 years. And based upon the valuation performed as of June 30th, 2010, that was met. So the contributions along with the assets are sufficient to pay any unfunded liability over 30 years. Second measure is called the funded ratio. And that's a ratio of the actuarial value of assets to the accrued liability of the plan. If that ratio is 100% or greater, then there are more assets as of the valuation date needed to cover that accrued liability. If it's under 100%, then there's less assets available. As of the valuation in 2010, that ratio was 92%. So there were sufficient assets on an actuarial basis to cover 92% of the accrued liability. The asset gains in 2010 and the corrective actions effective in 2010 brought the funded ratio back over 95% in 2010. So the 92% was the level of funded ratio back in 2009. With corrective actions and good investment performance for the year ending June 30th, 2010, the funded ratio increased above 95%. On a market value basis, in 2009, that ratio was 76%. So given the drop in the markets, the amount of assets available on a market value basis at that time, back in 2009, was 76%. But based on the corrective actions and the turnaround in investment performance of the fund, that ratio increased to 88% in 2010. Turning to page 3, there's a description there of the distribution of the funding requirements. Now, The funding contributions pay for three things. First, they pay for the cost of the accruing benefit, and that's all referred to as the normal cost. Second, they pay for expenses for administering the plan. And thirdly, a payment on an amortization payment to pay for the unfunded liability. Now, that includes principal and interest on the unfunded liability. For the fiscal year 2010, based on the 2009 valuation, the unfunded liability grew to over $600 million, and as a result, there was an increase in the amortization payment to about 2.3% of pay. Expenses were 2.2% of pay, and the normal cost payment was 11.3% of pay. So on an actuarial basis, the requirement to meet the board's funding policy required a contribution of 13.8% of pay. That was greater than the anticipated contribution based on state statutes of 12.5%. And this was before corrective actions. So after corrective actions and with investment returns for the year ending June 30th, 2010, the 2010 valuation determined that there was a reduction in the unfunded liability from $609 million in 2009 to $273 million in 2010. So as a result, the amortization payment decreased to 1% of pay from 2.3% of pay. Expenses was level at 0.2%, and the normal cost was 11.3%. So for fiscal year 2011, based on the 2010 valuation, the funding policy of 12.5% was met by the anticipated contribution from members and employers of 12.5%. Now, the fiscal year experience for SDRS in 2010, there was a gain of 18.73% rate of return on the market value of assets, and it was significantly higher than the assumed rate that we use in that actuarial calculations of 7.75%. It resulted in an investment gain of $492 million. The actual investment return was a little over $1 billion, less the expected return of $519 million, yielded an investment gain of $492 million. So that gain, along with the corrective actions, balanced the system on an actuarial basis. Turning to page 4, the funded status comparison shown here shows the 2009 calculations versus the 2010 calculations. We're showing that ratio both on an actuarial basis, the actuarial value of assets, and on the market value of assets. Now, the market value has a lot of volatility in it. From one year to the next, there may be investment gains or losses. The actuarial assets are developed on a very smooth basis. Now, in 2009, the funded ratio had dropped from the previous year from about 97% down to 92% on an actuarial value of asset basis. With the large drop in the asset values due to the severe recession, the market value of asset funded ratio was down to 76%. Now, what we've also done is we've shown the comparisons with the peer group that includes a report by Wilshire Associates on the funded ratios of other large statewide systems. The funded ratio in 2009 on an actuarial basis was 72%, and on a market value basis was 59%. So in both those cases, those measurements, SDRS was significantly above the peer group in the funded ratio. In 2010, the measurement of the funded ratio on actuarial value increased from 92 to 96%. And on a market value basis, increased from 76 to 88% for SDRS. The average from that peer group measurement was fairly level on an actuarial value from 72 down to 71%, and a slight increase on market value from 59 to 65%. So it gives you a relative measurement of the funded status of SDRS when compared to other statewide systems. Next is a summary of the liabilities and what we call the resources. The left side of this graph, it's a bar graph, the left side shows the values in 2009 based on the 2009 actuarial valuation. And on the right side, the bars indicate the values based on the 2010 actuarial valuation. Total assets and liabilities of the systems from 2009 to 2010 was fairly level at roughly $8.7 billion. In 2009, the left bar shows the liabilities broken out between active members and retired members. And the right side shows the assets, which include the actuarial value of assets, future expected contributions, and the unfunded liability, which is expected to be paid for by amortization payments. So last year, that unfunded amount was $609 million, and in 2010, because of the investment return as well as the corrective actions, has decreased down to $273 million, sufficient enough to be amortized by the contributions being made. Now, just in summary on page 5, although SDRS suffered substantial asset losses during 2008 and 2009, there are significant asset gains during fiscal year 2010 and corrective actions which have brought the plan back in accordance with the board's funding policy. And that policy is to pay the normal cost, the accruing benefits, and amortize the unfunded liability over a period not to exceed 30 years. Now, there were SDRS initiatives that they took back in 2009 because of the funded situation at that time. Under state statutes, there's a requirement that the board review the funding status of the system and make a report to the governor and the Retirement Laws Committee if any of the triggers are met. The first is that contributions do not meet the actuarial requirement for funding. So if the contributions defined by statute aren't enough to pay for the accruing benefits and amortize that unfunded liability, then there's a report that's made to the Retirement Laws Committee and the governor. Or if the funding ratio is less than 80%, or the ratio based on the market value of assets is less than 80%. In other words, those two different measures, those funded ratios, whether it be on actuarial or market value, if those are under 80%. And the third is that the market value of the assets is less than 90% of the actuarial value. So in that instance, then there's been a significant drop in the market value of assets that needs to be reported. Turning to page 6, shows how those triggers were, whether or not they were met in 2009 and in 2010. In 2009, the contributions did not meet the actuarial requirement because the amount required to pay the normal cost and amortize the unfunded liability over a period of not more than 30 years was not met. The funded ratio on an actuarial value basis was 92%, and that's above 80%, but on a market value basis was below 80% at 76%. So that condition was not met. And thirdly, the market value ratio to actuarial value was 83%. So the market value was 17% less than the actuarial value in 2009. So that 90% requirement meant that that condition was not met. So neither of those three conditions were met in 2009. Based upon the 2010 valuation, after corrective actions and after good investment returns, the contributions now are actuarially sound. They're enough to meet the normal cost and pay unfunded liabilities over 30 years. The funded ratios, both on an actuarial basis and a market value basis, are over 80%, so that condition is met. And the market value is 91% of the actuarial value, so the 90% condition is met. So there's been a significant change in the funded status of SDRS since 2009, a positive impact. Now, just a summary of the corrective actions that were taken. The first step was to adjust actuarial assumptions and methods and eliminate some subsidies. There were some minor actuarial assumption and method changes. There were modifications that were made to SDRS retirees who returned to cover employment. And there was legislation that was enacted to increase the contribution rate for participants in the optional spouses benefit program. Those last two removed any subsidies that were being provided to people that were participating in those two benefits. Second was a reduction in benefits that exceeded competitive practices. So legislation was enacted to eliminate first-year prorated COLAs. So someone has to now be in the plan for at least a year before they get a COLA. There's a modified employer refund for non-vested members. It dropped from 75% down to 50%, and for vested members from 100% down to 85%. The COLA was reduced to 2.1% in the first year. The system had a 3.1% fixed COLA, and so that COLA, cost of living adjustment for retirees, was reduced. And then future COLAs were modified to be indexed to the CPI based upon SDRS's funded status. And then finally, there's a number of initiatives that the board is undertaking for fiscal year 2011, including a comprehensive review that includes consideration of long-term benefit goals and fiscally sustainable benefit designs, an independent review of the recent investment performance. There's a quadrennial investment performance review that's currently being performed. We're also going to be working with SDRS on a comprehensive review of the economic and demographic actuarial assumptions that are used in the valuation to make sure that that those continue to be appropriate. There's a model that we're putting together to project the anticipated asset and liability experience. And then finally, there's an analysis and assessment of risks facing SDRS and its stakeholders that SDRS is undertaking. So with that, I'll answer any questions that you have.
Thank you very much for that report. Looks like we have some excellent job of covering the what appears to things that need to be covered. And appreciate that. Are there any questions from the committee? No? Okay. Apparently you've done a fantastic job this last year, and we're very pleased with it. When we think of the reports we were getting a little over a year ago and the hand-wringing that was going on and what was happening, I think you've made a lot of people happy with the reports that we can now give today. Thank you very much for the report, Mr. Slushinski. Thank you.
Dave for short.
Okay. Thank you very much for that report. If there is nothing else that we need to cover here, Mr. Wiley?
We have the joint meeting.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate your input and the information that you've rounded up and the fantastic job that you folks have done this last year. Makes a lot of people happy. Thank you. We'll turn it back over to Senator.
Thank you, Representative. I guess at this time I'll call for a motion for adjournment for the Senate Retirement Laws Committee.
So moved.
Is there a second? Discussion? It's not discussable, I know. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. We're adjourned.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate you all being here and joining us. That doesn't mean the rest of us are done. Okay. At this point, then, we'll go ahead and start with our discussion of the bills. As soon as I get the bills out, we'll start with House Bill number 1022. And it would be open for testimony for House Bill 1022. Again, need the name for the recording. Thank you. Proponents.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Rob Wiley with the South Dakota Retirement System. I'm just here to again say thank you for your support and all that we do with you and your efforts. South Dakota Retirement System brings three bills this year that you'll have all on your docket right here today, and we're happy to bring those for you. It is not as comprehensive as list as what we've looked at sometimes in the past, and I've actually asked my General Counsel, Wade Hubbard, to be carrying these bills, particularly the first bill, the Veterans Benefit Improvements. As you may know, Wade is a veteran of Vietnam-era conflict and very active in veterans issues and happens to be on the Veterans Commission. And no one more appropriate than he to bring this to you. I happen to have with me, and I'll pass out quick as Wade comes up, the fiscal notes that go with all these bills. I don't believe you have those yet, and I'll just do my little page thing again real quick here.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Riley. And we can welcome Mr. Wade Hubbard to the mic.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Again, for the recording, and those listening or watching at home, I'm Wade Hubbard, a general counsel of the South Dakota Retirement System. As Rob mentioned, House Bill 1022 does deal with veterans. It would be very easy for me this afternoon to say SDRS is a federally qualified system. We have to follow federal laws. There are two that need some compliance. Please pass the bill and let it go at that. But my experience has shown that you folks really like to know how the system works and the constraints that it has to follow and what it does for the membership. And so if the committee will bear with me a little bit, I'll explain this bill as briefly as I can, but with the depth that I think is required for a full understanding by the committee. The first section is pretty straightforward and pretty simple. Over the years, we've only had one statute that dealt with veterans or individuals called into military service, so we haven't really had a definition for qualified military service. We've just used generic phrases here and there. However, one statute we've had is being doubled in Section 2. We have another brand new statute in Section 3 and a modification to one of our supplemental retirement plan statutes in Section 4. Therefore, we thought it was wise to go ahead and add a definition for qualified military service, which is based on a federal definition, to our section that has all of our definitions. That's all that Section 1 does. Continuing on to Section 2 of the bill, again, we are a qualified system. We have to follow certain federal laws in order to get the benefits for our members of being a qualified system. Primarily, we deal with the Internal Revenue Service to a significantly lesser degree. We deal with the United States Department of Labor. For purposes of this bill, there are two federal acts that come into play. The first is USERA or USERA, depending on how you want to pronounce it. I'll call it USERA today. That's short for Uniform Services Employment and Reemployment Rights Act. That was passed in 1994. The other is a more recent act. It's called the HART Act. That was passed in 2008 by Congress. That's short for HEROES, Earning Assistance and Relief Tax Act. Before I talk much more about the federal acts, let me talk about SDCL 3-12-86. That is an SDRS statute that has been on the books since SDRS came into being in 1974. It actually goes back farther than that. The first version of the statute appeared in the old Public Employee Retirement System statutes in 1970, and that was amended to be pretty close to today's statute in 1973. It came into SDRS when SDRS was created by consolidating several public retirement systems, including the old public employee retirement system in 1974. Basically, the law on the books says that if one of our members goes on administrative leave for military purposes, in other words, called to active duty, that when the individual comes back, if the individual returns to active membership in SDRS, now they don't have to go back to their old job, they don't even have to go back to their old employer, just to come back to active membership in SDRS within 1 year of their discharge from the active commitment, and the individual works for 1 year, we are going to give them credited service towards their retirement for that entire period that they were gone, just as though they had stayed here and continued working for their public employer. We don't ask for any contributions or anything from them. This is simply cost-free to that individual. This has worked beautifully for the 36 years that SDRS has been going along. In 1994, of course, when USERRA was first passed, we examined it, but we didn't enact any statutory language that dovetailed directly with USERRA because 3-12-86 is a better deal. So we never had to worry about compliance for all these years until recently. Every time that an individual had been called to active duty and had come back and worked, they worked for a year and got their credited service and away they went. I'm reminded of one story fairly recently. It's a bit of a sad story, but I think you'll enjoy hearing this. We had a member go to Iraq, got beat up pretty bad, came back to employment with the city of Aberdeen. And I'm happy to mention his employer because they deserve a lot of credit. The individual couldn't function like he had before, but they kept him on the books, finding things for him to do, with our blessing, for one full year, until he met the requirements and we could give him cost-free credited service for the time that he was gone, including convalescent time before he came home. That's how it works, and that's the way we want it to work, and we've been proud of that. But last fall, we had our first exception. Now, let me back up and just talk very briefly about USERRA and its guiding principle. It's called the escalator principle. The idea is that an individual called into service for his or her country should not lose anything in the deal. They should at least break even. Therefore, the individual is on an escalator going up in their job and in their career. They get called into active service. They step off of the escalator. The escalator keeps moving while they're gone. But when they come back, they don't get back on where they were. They get back on the step that they had been on before, as though they were never gone. USERRA was written primarily for the private sector, and in particular, individuals who have established promotion schedules, raise schedules, and that sort of thing. And they are to receive everything they would have if they hadn't gone. As is usual, Congress writes its laws for the private sector, and then the public sector is expected to try to fit in. In this particular case, Congress made one exception for public retirement systems. And that is, while private sector systems tend to have employer-only contributions, public systems, and SDRS is a perfect example, have employee contributions also. Consequently, Congress amended USERRA to say that if it's a public system, or even a private system, that require employee contributions, that the individual will get that credited retirement service for the time they were gone, but they have to make the employee contributions that they would have made had they been there. essentially a way of saying no truly free lunch. Again, we had never worried about that because we were giving the service cost-free under the if the individual came back within a year and worked for a year. A gentleman came back last fall. He was called into active duty for 3 months to deal with the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. Then they kept him, the Army kept him another 3 months. And then they had another thing they wanted him to do. By the time he was gone, by the time he came back, he'd been gone 4.5 years. It may not have been a big deal if he worked in an office where they had, let's say, 30 bookkeepers. You know, you can get by with 29 for a while, or if you don't, you can add a 31st desk when the person comes back. That didn't work here. He was very well educated, a very professional position, and the only one. Naturally, his employer didn't keep the position open for the 4.5 years he was gone. He came back, said, "I'm back. Where's my job?" They gave him the job, but they really didn't have room for two of these individuals. Things were uncomfortable. After a month, he left. He had another job opportunity. So he didn't fulfill the one-year requirement under 31286. But he understood USERRA, and he wrote a letter, and he said, "Where do I send my check to give my credited service?" And the federal law prevails. We had to do that. We worked. His employer made the employer contributions for that period of time. He sent his check, and he got the service. That's well and good under the federal law. But we also, as a state agency, have to follow the dictates of the legislature. And we'd never asked you for authority to do this under USERRA. This is our request. It may be another 36 years before we have another one of these. But we need this on the books just for that circumstance when 3-12-86 in its present form doesn't work. I've covered quite a bit of ground. Are there any questions at this point?
Questions? Representative Wick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Hubbard, you said something that I just want to see clarified. But you said that as he went up the escalator and he got off the step here and the escalator kept going, you said he'd get back on the step where he was. I think what you really meant, if I understand it right, is where he would have been.
Yeah, not the location where he was, the step where he was.
Where he would have been if he stayed on the escalator.
Exactly, sir.
Okay,
yes, sir.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Additional questions?
I guess I would have one for you, Mr. Hubbard. On the sheet here, it says liabilities by approximately $5 million to $10 million over the next 10 years. Where is that? Why is it going? Where'd you get that figure, 5 to 10 million? How'd you come about to that conclusion?
Mr. Chairman, our actuaries determined that. They have had to operate under, and you're testing the absolute width of an attorney's understanding here. But they've had to make assumptions, and Dave can probably help me out here if necessary. How often would this occur? How many of these individuals will come back and gain the service? That's the entire bill, by the way, sir. Section 2 probably won't have much of an impact there. It is more Section 3, which deals with the Hart Act, which I'll be happy to talk about in a moment, sir. But, Dave, have I said anything wrong?
No, we made estimates. And then the impact on the benefit and then the value of the benefits. So that's how the 5 to 10 million is.
Okay. I can see why it would be that big a range because of what you're trying to evaluate here. And that even seemed high to me for the ones, but that's good. I guess we'd rather be on that side of it than to be short. So, any other questions from... Oh, okay. Representative Rick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Along that line, I guess I would wonder, and I don't know if the answer would be best from Dave or from Mr. Hubbard, but certainly now, if we're going to be in the actions that our Guard members have been in for the last few years, if that continues, it probably won't be 36 years. So do you take that into consideration when you came up with your $5 to $10 million? Okay, follow up?
Yes.
Then perhaps it's something that we should watch for at least for a period of time here and see, because with the numbers that we have that are being involved in what we're dealing with in the on the other side, it could be more than just one every 36 years, and I think might have a different effect. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Representative Wick, if I might follow up on that just a bit. Again, in the section we've been talking about, the individual does pay contributions, and the employer also. This individual probably started retirement benefit within just a few years, so we won't have much time to invest that money. So there is an impact there, but I think you'll see, sir, that the much larger impact will come out of Section 3. That's the one we'll really want to think about. And yes, if we stay in these kinds of actions eternally, we'll want to watch our experience. I think the actuaries are probably guessing right now on what our actual experience will be. But, you know, as best they can. But, Mr. Chairman, if you'd like, if there are no further questions, I'll go into Section 3, and I think we'll understand a little bit better the actuarial impact of it.
Yes, please do. Thank you.
Section 3 comes from the Hart Act that was passed by Congress in 2008. There are really two parts. And as you'll see, that new section in Chapter 3-12 has two paragraphs. Those are the two parts. They do two somewhat similar things, but two actually different things. The Hart Act requires, not voluntary, requires that a qualified system, be it public or private, handle the death of a member in military service by treating that death as though the member had returned to active membership in the system the day before the death. In other words, was in the system, just like any other member who might pass away. And consequently, then, would require that public or private system, including SDRS, to pay the survivor benefits that would be paid for the death of any member. As you can see, folks, Representative Wick especially, that could be significant. A fairly young individual in the Guard with a spouse and young children gets killed, not even necessarily violently, maybe during training here in the States. It makes no difference. That individual, we're going to take care of that surviving spouse and those kids. And that surviving spouse is eventually going to have a benefit at age 65. So, yeah, that can be costly, and we'll see how that works out. But I don't think anybody minds it. It's, in a way, of thinking, the least we could do for under that circumstance. The second paragraph, and I didn't provide very many details there, but I think everybody probably has a feel for it. The second paragraph deals with disability. This is voluntary. We don't have to do this. But it does essentially the same thing. It says that if one of our folks is on military leave of absence and they become disabled, we're going to go ahead and consider them at the proper point to be back active in the system. And we'll therefore treat them like any other active member of the system who becomes disabled, including disability benefits until retirement and so forth. Again, this is voluntary under the Hart Act. But our staff recommended to the board that it be
something they consider, and the board thought it was appropriate for these folks. Are there any questions on that section?
Any questions from the committee? No.
I'd like to continue. Oh, and by the way, when we're thinking of the expense of this, when the Hart Act first came out, I read it and I reread it, and what bothered me was that USERRA had said, to get the service, you make the contributions. I thought, where do the contributions come from here? They don't. This is a change in federal philosophy. We're not going to go to that surviving spouse and say, if you pay the contributions, then we'll give you the benefits. This is cost-free. Same with the disability.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if you'd like me to continue, the last one is relatively simple. It deals with our supplemental retirement plan, our Section 457 plan. I think most of you are at least somewhat familiar with that. Section 457 plan says that the individual cannot withdraw their voluntary contributions, their money. It's essentially a 401k for public employees. They can't withdraw their money until they terminate or retire or have passed away, except under limited circumstances. One of those is unforeseeable emergencies, and those are pretty tight. The Hart Act added another provision that says an individual who is participating in the supplemental retirement plan and faces some sort of economic hardship, and they don't have to prove any particular economic hardship. It's just if they're called to active duty, they can withdraw their part or all of their funds, even though they have technically not terminated employment. And that's a nice feature for these folks. A lot of them take a financial hit to get called off for a year or two. Any questions, folks?
Any questions from the committee? No? I think you've done an excellent job of clarifying the bill for us.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Hubbard. Are there any other proponents who want to testify? Any other proponents? Yeah. If not, any other opponents? No other opponents? Okay. I'd like to go to committee questions if we have some. Close the opponent, proponent, and go just for questions. Any questions from the committees? No. Okay, then we would like to no committee discussion. How about some committee action?
Sure.
Representative Feinstein.
I move to pass.
Okay. Okay, it's been moved and seconded. I'd like to call for a vote from our secretary.
Representative Steele.
I guess I'm supposed to restate that's been made a motion made and seconded. So then we'll go forward, right? Okay. He's going to keep me on the straight and narrow here. Thank you.
The motion is to pass on House Bill 1022. Representative Feinstein.
Aye.
Kirschman.
Aye.
Perry.
Aye.
Wick.
Aye.
Steele.
Aye.
Okay, there are 5 yeas.
Okay. Okay. Okay, 5-0, and the House Bill 1022 is passed. Being it is a veterans bill, and the one that I'm thinking is probably the longest veteran among us, Representative Wick, if you'd be willing to carry that on the floor.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Wick. Representative Wick.
Mr. Wick.
Okay. We will then go on to our next bill, which is House Bill 1023. Do we have any proponents for 1023?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Again, Wade Hubbard, General Counsel of the South Dakota Retirement System. 1023, blessedly, is a lot simpler than the last bill. Pretty straightforward. It deals with children in the SDRS structure, and primarily it's all cleanup. Those of you that have been involved with the system in the Retirement Laws Committee for a while know that I get pretty anal about our statutes, and I worry about them having all the detail that I think they ought to have. And you're going to see some of that here. Section 1 deals with SDRS disability benefits. If a member becomes disabled, we're going to pay the member 50% of their final average salary upon disability, plus an additional 10% for each child. So if a member becomes disabled with two children, they're going to draw 70% of the final average salary. And that gets indexed up over a period of time. The law doesn't say anything about an additional child if a new one shows up. What do? Historically, we have just increased the benefit. Say now there's three children, we're up to 80%. That's what we've been doing. We've never had authority to do that. That's what Section 1 would do. It's already in law that when a child becomes old enough that they're no longer considered a child for SDRS purposes, that that benefit is reduced. That's in disability law. However, we don't have anything like that for family benefits. Family benefits work much the same way. If a member passes away, a surviving spouse is going to get 40% of the member's final average salary, plus 10% per child, although you can't go over 100%. Although it's already mentioned in our disability law that when a child reaches the limits, that's age 19 in SDRS, that the benefit is thus reduced. However, we don't have anything like that for our family benefits. All that Section 2 would do is put that into law. I mean, it's common sense. It's what we've done over the years. As each child turned 18 or now 19, we changed the law a couple of years ago, the benefits reduced, and when there are no more children, then the benefit ceases until the surviving spouse will eventually get a retirement benefit. But there's no benefits for a while unless they've purchased the additional survivor protection. Again, this is how we've done it forever. It's common sense, but we've never had a provision in the law. Section 2 would do that now. Finally, those of you who were on board in 2008 will recall that we raised the age for a child in SDRS from 18 to 19. Probably the majority of family benefits are paid to a surviving spouse and kids, and it's all one payment to that spouse. However, we have some children who are covered that either literally or technically don't have a parent. Literally, if they're an orphan. Technically, if usually this would be a case of divorce, SDRS would no longer recognize the ex-spouse as a spouse. So instead, we pay benefits directly to a conservator on behalf of the child. The child gets a 20% benefit, 20% of the final average salary of the late member. But you can't just give a lump of money to a kid. A 5-year-old doesn't know what to do with it, and a 14-year-old has some real bad ideas on what to do with it. So as in other areas of the law, a conservator is appointed to handle the finances for the child. That was never a problem until we changed the law 2 years ago, raised the age to 19. Now we have 18-year-olds that are receiving benefits, and if we followed our law specifically right now, we would have to pay that money to a conservator. But the child at 18 has reached the age of majority. They're an adult. We have been paying the benefits directly to that child for the last year. But again, we've never technically had authority to do that. That is what Section 3 would do. So again, folks, this is a cleanup bill. When I worked for the LRC, we used to call it codifying reality. And that's what this bill does. Mr. Chairman, are there questions?
Okay. Well, I would first check to see if there is any other proponents, which, as it appears, any other proponents. I think if you'd like to stay there, Mr. Willard, I will. If you have to relinquish your seat, we'll...
Okay.
And if not, any other opponents? Any other opponents? Okay, any questions from the committee members? Yes, Representative Kirschman.
Mr. Chairman, what would the average size of a check be to an 18-year-old under this?
Well, that, Mr. Chairman, if I may answer, Representative Kirschman, that would vary a lot because, again, it's 20% of the late member's final average salary. And, of course, we have an extreme range of salaries in SDRS, so it would just depend on the child's wisdom in picking the parent, I guess, is it? Pick a parent that's a doctor.
Follow-up question, Chairman. Yeah. Just take a ballpark.
Again, we're numbers, and I'm an attorney.
Average salary is somewhere around the $40,000 to $50,000. If it's 40, 20% of that 40.
8,000
a year.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee? I have one. Just for clarification for myself here, it says the conservator. What happens if it's one of the parents is still alive and the child is being taken care of this way? Even though there is a parent alive, when they turn 18, they're of age, and they still get the money till they're 19. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that is correct. If it is a parent, a living parent that we recognize as a surviving spouse, then the checks will continue to the parent, even though the child is between 18 and 19. This is strictly... checks going directly to a child via a conservator.
Okay.
And the other logical question then is the if there's a surviving parent that we don't recognize as a spouse, is that a conservator? Technically, no. They have to be appointed by the court.
Okay. Appreciate that clarification. Thank you. Any other discussion or committee action? Representative Perry?
Move to pass.
Okay. Do I hear a second? Okay. Seconded by Representative Kirschman. Okay. We'll call Secretary. It's been moved and seconded. I'd like the Secretary to take a call. Roll vote.
Representative Feinstein?
Aye.
Kirschman?
Aye.
Perry? Wick?
Aye.
Steele?
Aye.
Chair, there are 5 days.
Okay. That has passed. Looking at this one. Pardon? Yes, Representative Wick.
Can we put this one on the consent calendar?
It's been moved. Do I hear a second for that? Okay. Moved and seconded to put on the consent calendar. We will do so. Okay. Thank you. They're very sure we got 2 seconds. That's good. Okay, let's go on to our final bill then. Oh, yes, I do. Thank you. That's why we keep these people here. We're needed. We need to have a voice vote on this. So those who are in favor of this, I'd like a yay.
Consent calendar,
I got to have a voice vote. Okay. Those in favor, I'd like a yay. Okay. Any nays? We meet. Okay, we're all set.
Great.
Thank you. Keep us doing it right. Okay, we'd like to go to the third bill to be considered, which is 1024, and the next proponent, Mr. Wade Hubbard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, again for the record, and folks listening in or whatever, I am Wade Hubbard, General Counsel to the South Dakota Retirement System. Our first bill was for veterans. The second bill is for children. Logic would follow that the third bill would either be for apple pie or motherhood. but in actuality, it's a pretty straightforward little bill. It deals with our Board of Trustees and vacancies and so forth. The first section is, again, one of those where I went through and said, this doesn't seem to flow right, because I always worry about things like that. I've got a great boss. I've got a great board. I come in and say, this doesn't seem right to me, and they say, oh, okay, Wade, go ahead, draft it up. Current law says that a trustee shall continue to serve until his successor has been designated and has qualified. This is when trustee's term has expired or whatever, or they have left for one reason or another. I got to thinking about that, and I thought, well, that sounds kind of silly to me. If they're disqualified under 312.53, or if they resigned, and particularly resigned and moved to Florida or something like that, or if the trustee has passed away, how is the trustee going to continue to serve until his successor comes on the board? That seems silly. So that's why I put in this additional language, or offered this additional language to our staff and then our board, and now you folks, saying unless they've resigned, deemed resigned by statute, or they've passed away, they'll continue to serve until their successor is qualified. Section 2 is more significant. This deals with replacements of trustees. There's a fairly onerous replacement procedure in our administrative rules at ARSD 6201-0705. But basically what the statute says right now is that once we have, or the board has a vacancy, and the board has gone through the process to appoint a trustee for the remainder of the vacant term, the individual nonetheless has to run in the next trustee election just for approval to fill out the remainder of that term. Quite often it's 1 year. We've had two or three of these happen fairly recently, and the person has had to run for a normal SDRS election to fill 1 year. Terms are 4 years, by the way. Then, presuming the individual liked their 1 year on the board and they want to serve again, they run again the next year. That seemed kind of onerous, all things considered. This would allow the board to appoint a trustee to fill a vacancy pursuant to its procedures, which involves, by the way, the folks that the trustee represents, putting in nominations and so forth. It involves them. The trustee looks at applicants, looks at resumes and so forth, and says, this is the right person. That person ought to be able then to fill out the remainder of the term without having to run immediately. And then thereafter, when the term is done, if they want to stay on the board, they run as in the normal manner. That's pretty much it.
Thank you, Mr. Hubbard. Again, the same procedure, and maybe a little bit of clarification for those who may be listening in. These bills are at the request of the South Dakota Retirement System, so it's a little bit different in calling on our proponents. I believe we already know that, but I'll go through the procedure. And the opponents, just for following the rules and regulations that we have. So that is why I do ask if there is any other proponents to testify. No other proponents, close that. And any opponents? Any opponents? Okay, we will close that part and ask for any committee questions at this time. think you've done an excellent job of clarification of that for us. Is there any other committee discussion or committee action?
Mr. Chairman, move due pass on 1024.
Okay. It has been moved by Representative Perry and seconded by Representative Wick. Secretary will call the roll.
Representative Feinstein.
Aye.
Kirschman.
Aye.
Perry.
Aye.
Wick.
Aye.
Steele.
Aye.
Mr. Chair, there are 5 yeas.
Okay. This bill is passed. And any further action? Folks.
Move
on
consent calendar.
Move consent, okay. And seconded? And okay, appreciate that. We will take a vote then for that. Those in favor of putting the bill on the consent calendar, favor, say aye.
Aye.
Okay. Any against, say nay. That bill goes on the consent calendar. All right. Good. Any further committee action? If not, voice vote to adjourn.
Second.
Okay, voice vote. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay, nay? No. Okay, we are adjourned.